Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, college football writer with the Associated Press. Two guest show today. First up, a big get. Ohio State coach Ryan Day joins us to talk about a fascinating offseason for the Buckeyes. They went into it on a two-game losing streak, but almost everything since then has been good news, encouraging, really uplifting. They practically won the offseason in Columbus for whatever that's worth. Momentum on the recruiting trail, hiring a big-name offensive coordinator twice, and a plethora of players coming back to Columbus to play an extra year when they could have gone to the NFL draft. These are high-pressure but also very promising times at Ohio State. Then Bud Elliott from CBS Sports and the Cover 3 podcast joins the show to talk about intriguing quarterback competitions around the country and USC's recent recruiting hot streak. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. If you like what you hear, please give us a good rating and review. It helps college football fans find us. It helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me today on the podcast, the coach of Ohio State, Ryan Day. Ryan, thank you so much. It's been an interesting offseason for the Buckeyes. I'm looking forward to diving into it a little bit. And spring ball, you are at what point in spring ball, Ryan?
Going into practice 10.
All right.
So we go Wednesday and then Friday, and then we have a week next week, and then our spring game is on April 13th.
Excellent. All right. So again, there's no such thing as not a busy time day in your business. So I appreciate you squeezing me in. Let's start with spring ball. And one of the things that was interesting to me, or as I was thinking about what to ask you, is Ohio State this year has a lot of players returning that I think there was a possibility that they wouldn't return, right? You got a lot of great news during the offseason about some kids, especially on the defensive side, like Jack and Travion on the offensive side. Experienced players who could have probably explored the NFL decide to come back. That's great for talent because they're really super players. But I'm wondering, when you have an influx of experienced players like that, especially at a place like Ohio State, where you don't necessarily always get that. A lot of times your juniors are heading out the door. How does that change the way you can coach in the offseason in terms of setting culture, in terms of empowering your players, if you know you got guys who have been here, good players, and they know what you're about?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. That's a great question. I think that was the first part of the offseason. And so you look back every year and try to identify the things that you need to enhance, the things you got to change, and what you look for to, you know, kind of, you know, get that last drive or that last play the last couple of years. And I think one of them is, to your point, experience and continually trying to get that into the program because, to your point, you know, we've had a lot of super talented guys that, they're in the NFL now that still have eligibility. And that's not easy to watch those guys play so well in the NFL, knowing they could still be at Ohio State. But one of the most important things was having all these guys come back. You know, like you said, Cody Simon and Lathan Ransom and Denzel Burke and JT and Jack, Tyleek, Trey, Emeka, Donovan Jackson. You know, there's a lot of guys.
It's more than I even thought, really.
And they were all first or second round grades, maybe, you know, at the latest, early third. So that was very important. And then the next piece was adding the recruiting class along with the portal. But with the portal, to bring in Will Howard and Seth McLaughlin, who both 22-year-old guys, veteran, been around, played in big-time football games, conference championships. And then add a few more pieces there, obviously with Quinshon and Will, and then Julian was, and then Caleb. So, you know, a couple of younger guys, but also guys with experience. And so I think all of that combined with some of the talent that we brought in with the recruiting class has made for an exciting spring. But, you know, I think the biggest thing, like you said, is guys have been through a season before and know that it's a long run to the end of the season. And that it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, and especially next year, knowing how the 12-team playoff is going to change the length of the season, that's also playing into it. So a lot of things to consider, but we have gotten older the last couple of years.
Yeah, so you opened the door to a couple of different things there. Let me hit on Will Howard, the quarterback situation, Julian saying, so as a writer, and I'm sure some of your fans have a great time saying, like, okay, we have Will for this year, and maybe Devin's the experienced backup. So they, you know, you can already chart like what a fan would look at when he looks at your quarterback room. And then Julian and Air will be like our ready to go next year. But that's not reality, right? Because you're trying to create competition where all these guys can play. But when you also have that much talent, there has to be, you can't have everybody getting the exact same amount of reps, I don't think. So how does a quarterback competition at Ohio State work with the talent and experience level of players you have?
Well, I think the first thing is, like you said, you know, we can't put these guys in boxes and label them and say, this is, you know, your role this year, like get out there and play. And that's one of the things that Chip has always done. And I think he's done a great job of this spring is, you know, going into practice 10, but you know, Julian Sang gets reps with the ones and Will and Devin get reps with the threes and we just roll the guys in there. And so it's a great opportunity to see them problem solve, to see them with, you know, different styles of talent out there, different receivers. And it gives us a good opportunity to just allow them to compete. It's been extremely fair. And as time has gone on, you're starting to see, you know, different guys enhance certain areas and then improve their weaknesses. So that's been great. But, you know, we're still not there yet. We're still, you know, got two more weeks here. And I think these 2 weeks will be important in their development.
All right. So again, like you open up a door, a couple of questions there. Obviously, I want to get to the offensive coordinator stuff. So we're going to put the other one aside here. You made two big name hires this offseason. You know, Bill O'Brien seemed like a slam dunk when you hired him, but then things change. Bill decides to take another job. Chip comes in. You have a previous relationship with Chip Kelly, former head coach for a couple of different places. Let's start with this. I'm wondering, when you were deciding to make this pivot to an experienced offensive coordinator, someone who could take the play calling from you, knowing your relationship with Chip, did you talk to him about this before you got into the idea of hiring Bill? I'm wondering if there was any conversation between you and Chip when you hired Bill as to how this might work.
Yeah. Yeah, I've made it known.
And what those conversations were like, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I made it known that I had, you know, a few guys that were kind of on the A-list in my mind. There's a lot of great coordinators out there, but, you know, for the right fit for Ohio State, you know, this team in particular, this situation, our staff that's already in place on offense, you know, there was three guys that I felt like were the right fit. And then had conversations with all of them and had conversations with Chip. The timing wasn't great at the time with Chip, you know, and he still had a lot going on. And, you know, when you leave as the head coach, there's a lot that comes with that. But I think after we had gone through the process with Bill and he was in a different place just because of the timing and he had kind of come to grips, I think, in his mind with this opportunity. And so, you know, we moved in that direction and had, you know, conversations about what it could look like. But we've worked together before. So this wasn't, you know, we know we weren't going to, you know, be running the wishbone or, you know, they're running shoot. We knew exactly what it was because a lot of what we do now is what Chip did in the NFL. So there's just a lot of carryover there. We talk the same language. We've known each other a long time. So, you know, that part we didn't have to work through. And that allowed us to kind of move quickly when Bill was announced the head coach of Boston College.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, in those conversations with Chip, I would also imagine, aside from just the conversations about would you be interested in doing this? Were you able to work through with him before you even hired Bill, just simply the idea, the concept of doing this? I would imagine he would be a guy, and I'm sure you may have went to other coaches that you could say, hey, I want to run this idea off. I want to bounce this idea off you of me giving up play calling and what that might look like to me as a head coach. Because that's an interesting part of this, too. It's not just who you're going to hire. It's the act of giving it up. So whether it was Chip or anybody else, who did you talk to about that?
Not very many people, honestly. I knew I had conversations with Gene Smith about this a few years back, and I kind of felt like maybe this was the right move, but didn't quite move in that direction. And then when things started to change with NIL, with the transfer portal, there was just a lot more that was going on a daily basis, and, you know, calling donors and going to events and things like that really started to take priority. And that's when I knew that was the time. And I also knew, you know, the offense was in good place in terms of talent. We've done a great job recruiting with the type of players that we have. So it was an attractive position, not just because it was Ohio State, because the guys that are here, they're very talented, but they're a great group of guys. And I think Chip would echo that, you know, just been really impressed with their approach, their maturity, professionalism. And so, you know, that part of it as well, like I knew, you know, we were going to be handing over a really good group. And then also the guys in that room, you know, Brian Hartline, Justin Fry, Keenan Bailey. I mean, these guys are all really talented guys. So I felt like it was going to be a situation that, you know, someone could walk into and feel comfortable and know that they were going to have success.
How does it work, or how is this working out being Chip's boss for the first time? Does Chip have a boss? Can anybody be Chip's boss other than Chip's wife? I don't know. Like, how does that work?
No, I mean, he and I have always had a great relationship, and he's funny about it. You know, he made a few great comments. He's witty. But no, just, you know, I go to him for a lot of advice. And, you know, he and I, when he was the head coach, you know, he and I would have long conversations together just because of our relationship. And, you know, ultimately we all, you know, have to report to somebody. And, you know, this is just the situation here. But I think he, you know, he'd probably tell you that, you know, he enjoys right now just working on football and not having, you know, 12 meetings after a Saturday practice with recruits and their families, and then having to go to donor dinners at night. He can kind of focus on trying to score as many points as he can and building relationships with the players. And it's probably a little bit liberating, and I can see that sometimes I'm jealous. He's obviously great, and our relationship goes back a long time.
So I've been asking a lot of coaches this, and, you know, coaches at different stages. I asked Bill O'Brien this, and we had Jared Parker on from Troy. So a younger coach, first-time head coach. Bill's obviously seen a lot of different things and had a more experienced career. There's been so much talk about, oh, man, everything is changing in college football. It's chaotic. These coaches, I don't know if these coaches want to stay in these jobs, right? These coaches are getting out of college football if they can, because the jobs have become too hard, or it's too chaotic. I don't know. Like, I know it's hard. I know it's harder than it has ever been. I don't doubt that. But when you hear about that, when you hear that narrative, what do you think? Do you find yourself thinking the job is untenable now at times? Or obviously it's not, you're still there, but when you hear about coaches wanting to get away from college football, like, is college football still fun? I guess it's as simple as that. Can this still be a fun job?
Yeah, I think.
And rewarding?
Yeah, it used to be? Yeah, it started in really my first year, you know, 18, 19. And then, you know, those were, you know, crazy. It was my first kind of year. There's a lot going on there. And then COVID hit, and every year at Ohio State, there's a lot going on, and that's okay. That's part of the job. But I think oftentimes, like, you hear about the natural order of the universe is chaotic. It's just chaos. And that's kind of life, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you look back on history, there's been a lot of chaotic times and times where things are uncertain, but that's when leadership really is at its best. And, you know, while everyone's kind of losing their minds, you just try to stay steady. And the job itself is still impacting young people. You know, that's not changing. And so the description maybe is changing. We have to adapt right now, but it's still a great job, you know, and, you know, we're still having an impact on people. We still have an impact on coaches and families. So you can't lose focus on that. We still have an opportunity to put together a great team, a great culture of kids to go win championships. And by the way, we're all doing pretty good. I mean, they're paying us really well, and you know what I mean? So, like, it's still a great job with great opportunity to have an impact on people, and we have to just make sure we focus on that, not all the negative things. Although, it's still a challenge, and we all like to know exactly what's coming on a daily basis, and we like everything nice, neat, and clean, but that, unfortunately, is not life, and that's not new.
No, and I don't think it's I talk to a lot of young coaches. Like, you're still a young guy, Ryan, but I talk to coaches even younger than you, guys who are have yet to become a head coach, and I can hear some of the stress about the uncertainty and the chaos and all the things they need to do. NIL, transfer portals, constantly recruiting everybody, right? Kids on your roster, kids not, kids that you know in the portal. And what I'll try to tell them, like, listen, I don't know the answers here. I don't know why. Just because I'm old doesn't mean I know the answers. But what I would say is, like, I don't think it's going to stay this way. I do think we're in a period of evolution, and it could be tough to get there. You know, maybe this is an unfair question because I didn't prep you for it, Ryan. But, like, when you think of what this might become, do you have any ideas of, like, what would be a place where it would be less chaotic and how that looks?
Well, I think you're right. To think that it's going to stay the same, we know that's not true, because college football changes every single year, with the conference realignment, the playoff system, the portal, the NIL, collective bargaining. I mean,
that could be a possibility.
Yeah, all those types of things are possibilities down the road, and some of them are already happening. And it's like, you know that there's going to be change. It might be change back. It might be change to something new. And all you can really do is just do what you can to bring great people into your program that believe in what you do and treat them fairly, and then try to solve the problems that are ahead of you. Because a lot of it is just, out of our control. I think we're doing a great job. Tony Petitti in the Big Ten is having great conversations and meetings. I think we have a meeting today to talk about some things, and the communication's been excellent about trying to – come together to help, give our input on what's coming forward. But ultimately, it's going to come down to the commissioners and the presidents that are going to have to make these decisions. And we can try to inform the best we can, but we're going to have to rely on our leaders to do a great job in forging forward in an unknown time. But we have to do the best we can to continue to keep an academic format in mind, even though there's a lot of money at play. So, I wish I could sit here and tell you that I have all these great ideas, but the minute you start going down those wormholes, you can waste a lot of time, because a lot of it can be wasted energy, when I'd rather spend that on my time and on our team and spending it with our players and focusing on having a great day to day. So there's a lot here to worry about. So I try to leave that to our leaders and ADs, presidents, chancellors, and obviously the commissioners.
Yeah, probably a good, I would imagine a good rule of thumb on this is answer the questions when you're asked of them. Exactly. By Gene or Ross or the leaders in the conference. But maybe don't worry too much about trying to come up with solutions, because you can only have so much input anyway.
You got it.
Again, it's an off season that had a lot of change, staff changes. In fact, you just hired a running backs coach yesterday to replace Tony Alford. Carlos Lachlan. Carlos came from Oregon, so you literally just made a hire yesterday. You're still having staff changes. So much about what is going on at Ohio State under Ryan Day has been excellent. There have been three games that you have lost over the last couple of years that change the dynamic of a season. And all of a sudden you can get defined by those one games. And I think I remember asking you this 2 years ago, when the first time you lost to Michigan, but I'm going to ask it to you again. How do you balance? I have one of the best programs in the country. Things are working very well here. But we need to, as you said earlier, make one more play. Like, the margin is very thin here between what is a successful season and what is not. I want to always get better. How do you balance? I need to make changes, but boy, I have a lot of good things going on here. I don't want to mess up a good thing.
I think it's a great question. I think, like you said, when you look at our record here in the last, 4 or 5 years, a lot of wins, but there's also, the expectation at Ohio State is to win them all. And certainly the rivalry game is a big part of that. So, you can quickly, feel like you're not accomplishing, your goals, even though you can win them all except for one. And I think that's one of the challenges here at Ohio State in particular. I tell people all the time, we have a fan base of 12 million. If 95% of the people are really excited about what you're doing, but 5% aren't, it's still 600,000 people. So that's a lot of people. It's like right. some people's fan right. bases. So right. This job's not for the faint of heart. And after every year, what you have to do is identify the things that you feel like you need to do to continue to build and build a vision. I think that's what people want. People want a vision for how things are going to get addressed and get better and improve year after year after year. And we have a great culture. We have great coaches. We have great players. We have great support here. And we know what we need to do. You know, we got to get out there and we got to win our rivalry game this year. We got to, you know, make a run. And our goal is to, you know, win the rivalry game, win the national championship. And a bunch of guys came back to do that very thing. And so you know, I look at, you know, different teams and how many years of runs they've made where, you know, only one team's a national champion, you know. And so I do think it'll be interesting with the playoff because in the past, you know, it could be one or two bad calls or you know, one play that doesn't get made on one side of the ball could, you know, define your whole season. You know, with the playoffs, it'll be a little bit different, I think. You know, just there's a lot that goes with it now and, you know, it's going to be a little more of a playoff system. And so that'll be an interesting approach to it. But no, I mean, you know, it's about building that vision moving forward on the things that we need to address and correct. But there's so much positivity right now around our program and what we've done and plan to do this season. And that's really where our focus is.
Yeah, it is remarkable. You know, listen, I think I don't know what to make of the bowl game. I'm not trying to give you an excuse off the bowl game, Ryan,
sure,
but
sure.
Those games are hard to figure out how meaningful they are. I know you want to win them, but it's hard to extrapolate like conclusions from them.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, Ohio State with a 2-game losing streak is just not acceptable, right? It's just not.
Sure.
But then you know the idea that you went into the offseason like this, but now you in many ways, for whatever it's worth, have won the offseason, right? I guess what I would just say from sort of like maybe your own mental health perspective, how important was it to have good vibes around the program after the way last season ended? I just maybe not for you, for everybody in Columbus. I know how important Ohio State is to the, yeah, as you said, your massive fan base, to switch those vibes. How important was that?
Well, I think it's leadership. It's leadership. Yeah, and the bowl game. I mean, listen, anytime we play, it matters. Doesn't matter if we're, you know, playing checkers or spring game or, you know, a bowl game, it doesn't matter. But I just think the way that some of those bowl games are set up right now is just bizarre. You know, you look at the way that Georgia-Florida State game went. You know, we don't play with Marvin. We don't have our quarterback. And then our second-string quarterback rolls his ankle, you know, after a few drives. And we're playing with Lincoln, who's only been in the program for a few months. And it just, you know, it makes for a very difficult situation. I'm not making excuses. It's just the way it is. And so – yeah, coming off of that, it was not a good feeling. But at the same time, it was more about the focus moving forward. We knew that, you know, our goal wasn't to win the Cotton Bowl and you know, have a feel good. It's about, you know, winning national championships and conference championships and beating team up north. So you know, minute, you know, we didn't make the playoff. I mean, the focus went to that, and obviously wanted to play well in the game. That didn't happen. But you know, our goal was to get guys to come back and put a great team together and put the right people in the right seats. And that's what it was. And there was some difficult decisions that had to be made with on the team with players. This difficult decisions that had to be made with our staff. And so made those decisions, again, not for the faint of heart, but you got to do it. And especially when you care about people and, you know, everybody in the building, I think is a pretty tight knit group. You know, we care a lot about each other, but ultimately it's our job to make the decision what's best for Ohio State football and winning football games.
I'll let you out on this one, Ryan.
Yeah.
And it's Are you the type of guy who watches that Michigan game over and over and over? Or do you, you know, for whatever reason, maybe because you just want to torture yourself because you're making me feel, or are you the guy who says, listen, I got to let it go? How does that work?
I think you identify what needs to be done to win the game year after year. You know, you look back on, you know, what needs to be done and, you know, why did we lose the game you know, the first 2 years? You try to identify that. You know, I think we've identified that. What happened last year? I think we've identified that.
It was different, so, right?
Yeah.
I think you look at – I don't know if there was a common through line between the 3 years. 3 years, I don't think so.
Right. No, very different this past year. But
yeah.
But I think we've identified what that is. Again, when you look at personnel, when you look at scheme. We look at all those things, like what needs to happen in that game in order for us to win. And so you keep looking at it, you know, that part of it. But you don't sit there and torture yourself over plays that weren't made. You know, we can't do that. We got to go play an attack and play downhill. But we also need to put ourselves in position to be successful. And what are those things that need to be done? And so those are the more of the things that we focus on.
Ohio State coach Ryan Day, a couple of spring practices left, about 3 or 4 of them left. Hey, man, thank you so much for joining me today. Always appreciate the insight. Always appreciate the candor. And hopefully we'll run into each other, I don't know, maybe in Columbus, maybe in Phoenix if you go out there for a meeting or so. But hopefully we'll see each other in person throughout this offseason. Good luck with everything. Keep the kids healthy, okay?
You got it, Ralph. Thanks, man.
Joining me next on the podcast this week is the great Bud Elliott from CBS Sports. You can find him on the Cover 3 podcast with Tom Fornelli, Danny Cannell, Chip Patterson, a good group. Bud, man, thanks for joining me. There is no off season. We are still grinding. I know you are a grinder. Appreciate you joining me on the show.
Ralph, glad to be back, man. It's so exciting.
Yeah, so let's dive into a little spring football here. I just before you on the show this week, we talked to Ryan Day from Ohio State, and it got me thinking as I was planning to do that interview and talk to him a little bit about his quarterback situation, that it might be a good time to sort of whip around the country and try to come up with some interesting quarterback competitions. Now, sometimes the competitions aren't really competitions, in even though the coaches say they are. And now, of course, over the last couple of years, the other dynamic in the quote-unquote competitions is the loser going to stick around? So when you glance around the country, and maybe Ohio State is on that list, where are the places that you have your eye on as who's going to win this job and who might be heading to the portal come April 16th?
I think you have to start there in Columbus, although I'm partial to Howard after listening to our Bucknuts podcast on 24/7 Sports. They seem to be pretty sure he's going to win it, but yet, like, with some of these guys who are transfers, we have seen a lot more success with the second year of the transfer. And so it's his first year in the system. And it's not like he's a high level, like no doubt NFL stud type that you got for a 1 year rental. So I guess there's some chance he doesn't win. I think Ohio State is pretty interesting there.
Yeah, I think I even asked Ryan about this. You know, you get a situation where if you're an Ohio State fan, or even you and I, right? Like we chart, okay, well, if conventional wisdom tells me Howard's going to be the starter, ideally, now again, this isn't an ideal world. Devin Brown is your experienced backup, and you have Air Nolan and Julian Sain, you know, learning and waiting this year. And that's your competition heading into next year to see who's going to be the starter. Now, that's Pollyannish. And as you said, you know, sometimes these quarterbacks like Howard develop more in the second year. But I you know, what Day said is like, listen, we don't want to box them into roles initially. We want to let this play out. But it is hard to see a path here where Howard, after a 4-year starter at Kansas State, doesn't emerge. But I would also put it this way, and I'm wondering if maybe your head goes here a little bit, Bud. If he doesn't win the starting job, could that possibly be good news for Ohio State?
I see where you're going with this, with the idea that maybe he doesn't win it because we already have a pretty good idea what his baseline level of play is. And so if he doesn't win, that means one of these really high upside yet raw players for Ohio State like came out and took that job from him. I see where you're going with that. If that's where you're going with that, I think it makes a lot of sense. Maybe the pushback is, I mean, you went and got Chip Kelly to be your OC, who I think we all agree is like an offensive genius, whatnot. We love the run game stuff he does. He's like very good with mobile quarterbacks. Howard's a nice runner, especially like at the college level. So I still have a hard time seeing him not win it just because of the fit of that, right? Like you go out, you get two nice backs. You got Howard. You got some really nice young talent there at receiver. Being able to use that his legs, I think, in some of those games is probably pretty key.
Yeah, and I would think that the most likely guy to maybe end up somewhere else is Devin Brown. And I know, listen, Devin Brown, you know, almost seemed to be offended by the idea that he might transfer. And I get it. Like, I understand if you're a young player, you don't want to be seen as, hey, I'm bailing out of here. I want to compete. But I also, again, you have always I think, very well-grounded and realistic thoughts on this. When a guy like Devin Brown says, hey, I'm not a quitter, hey, man, like, we're not really accusing you of being a quitter anymore. I wonder if you think Brown is a guy, if he decided to go somewhere else. Like, is there a world where Devin Brown is a good college quarterback somewhere, even if it's not in Columbus?
I think so. And it's hard to evaluate what he is because, I mean, he got hurt almost immediately in the bowl game too, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
They had to play, Kindholz, I think it was? So, like, that – yeah, and that's a kid who's super raw out of like North Dakota. So I think there's certainly a chance for Devin Brown to still be a good quarterback, whether it's at Ohio State or elsewhere.
So where's your other spot that you're looking with a keen eye? And again, there could be several, and I'm wondering where you might be going.
I mean, so we did this. This actually took like almost two shows to try to dive in like every situation. But the reason is because the Big Ten took us like almost an entire hour. I think it's Michigan.
Yeah.
So you got first-time head coach in Sherrone Moore. You lose two receivers to the draft. You lose most of your offensive line. You lose your best back. Is it Jaden Dennegal? Is it Alex Orji, who they didn't really let throw a pass last year except for one time? Is it Jaden Davis, a true freshman who, you know, as a freshman in high school, was like probably the number one quarterback in the country, and other guys kind of progressed and passed him up a little bit? You know, Jack Tuttle, that's a good trivia question. Like who's the guy who's still in college from like 2017? Jack Tuttle has been around for forever, I feel like. Or do they go to the portal? I mean, spring window is coming open, and are you really confident in any of these guys? I guess it sort of depends on what you've seen internally, because they haven't shown much in games. And also, you know, sort of what are your expectations given the pieces you have around them? Because I think that defense is dynamite. So I think they should be expecting to make the playoffs still in Michigan.
Yeah, and Michigan is, and I'm wondering who else qualifies similarly to Michigan, where you think they'll be doing some shopping in the portal. If I were to ask you, maybe give you two or three teams that you think, whether they think they're done, maybe Michigan internally believes they're fine, but when you look at their depth chart, you think, I don't know if you're fine, and maybe you should go shopping.
Sure. Michigan, clearly, I think, could look at quarterback. Miami's going to need a back, especially since Henry Parrish transferred out, and you've had, you know, two of their better backs get hurt within the last year, and they don't really know if those guys, you know, will be healthy. I think Oklahoma could always use another offensive lineman, given how much they lost to the draft and to graduation. That's a really good question as far as who else needs something, you know, for sure in the spring window. I'm curious as to like what the supply is going to look like in the spring window. You know, a lot of people seem to think it's going to be, you know, absolute chaos, and maybe it will be, but how many guys' market value is that much different in the spring than it was in the fall? Like, due to desperation, I guess, of teams realizing this is their last bite at the apple? I don't know, but there's a lot of teams out there who probably need something.
Well, it becomes a, you know, even moving away from the quarterbacks, right? It does a Keon Coleman decide he wants to jump because the situation at his school, right? Like, I don't know if it, you know, listen, part of it, we all know what happens with tampering and what goes on behind the scenes, but I think back to Jordan Addison coming out after the spring, and it's almost like, who are the guys who we are having a hard time maybe anticipating might all of a sudden wake up and have a, you know, text message on their phone come April 14th that says, you know, hey, man, what do you think about X school? And we really didn't see the whole point of that is you have a hard time seeing those type of players coming.
The guy that I would look at, and I would comp him sort of to what Michael Pratt was last year, is Hennigan at Memphis, right? Like, he's a dude, I think he can play at the upper Power 5 level, and I know other schools do too because they went after him. Sort of behind the scenes in the initial window, and he just said no, apparently. So maybe Memphis has a good NIL deal with him, or maybe he just loves Memphis, or maybe a combination of both. And I mean, it's not a bad decision to stay. Like, he absolutely put up crazy numbers last year, and you can certainly get drafted out of a high-level American school. So I'm not encouraging him to leave, but like if I really needed a quarterback, I'm just kind of racking my brain here for somebody who's a good established starter and not like a backup who maybe could start. Like Hennigan's a guy we know probably could start, and now the Memphis coaches will probably hate me for mentioning his name. You know, like think about it. There's not a whole lot of guys who are like no doubt good starters on teams that maybe aren't very good or that don't have a lot of NIL.
And there's also not a lot of clear, you know, I think there at other time, you know, we mentioned Michigan, but I don't know if there's another high level team. You know, I probably should have prepared a little better for this, but I'm trying to roll through my head quickly about teams that I would consider playoff contenders that have some kind of uncertainty at quarterback. Now, again, Ohio State's uncertainty is they may have they have a lot of guys.
Yeah.
But I don't see another one like Michigan where I'm thinking quarterback is the big question mark on this team. And well, we've had that over the last couple of years where the question mark, like with Alabama last year, was, hey, I know we have a talented guy, but is that talented guy going to emerge?
Totally. If you think about like the teams who maybe could make the playoff this year, we have to think that Penn State, either Drew or Pabula, is going to be okay.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Michigan, we already talked about. Ohio State, we already talked about. Oregon almost certainly is going to be Dylan Gabriel.
Yeah, they got their guy.
Yeah, exactly. USC probably always considers himself a playoff contender.
Well, that was the other school I was going to bring up with you, too, is where is USC right now? And you look at Miller Moss after the bowl game and the kid they brought in from New Mexico State, who I'm now blanking on. You know, that looks like
Maeva Peters.
Yes, and that looks like a legitimate competition, you know, and again, I don't know how much to make a one bowl game, but that does look like a legit, like, we'll see, we'll figure that one out on opening day.
Completely. I going down my list and just looking at the playoff odds, Florida State, I feel like it will be DJU, barring Brock Lynn, like, really stepping up fast. Kansas State, clearly, like, Avery Johnson. Utah is interesting with Rising. Like nobody's really seen him play in over a year, so I am curious as to how that looks.
That Miami is an interesting one. Like, I think we want to just pencil in Rising as like, oh yeah, of course he's going to be the guy. And of course, I think if he's healthy and the same player, he will be the guy. Like, I don't think you would move away from that. But again, you haven't seen this guy play in 2 years. So to make the assumption that he can is maybe a little bit of a stretch.
The other one to watch for, I think, and I don't want it to be the case, but is Notre Dame. With Riley Leonard having another surgery and going to miss a good chunk of spring. Don't know if they're going to bring him back for spring at all. I mean, his sack avoidance numbers, like relative to pressure rate, were like Anthony Richardson level good, right? And that's kind of what made him so special. Go watch the Clemson game. They have him dead to rights in the backfield many times, and he just out the gate, right? And ends up, you know, pulling the upset over the Tigers. I don't think he's like an amazing thrower, so they do need his legs to be right there in South Bend to get the full value of what they thought they were getting.
Yeah, and then if it's not, Riley, then who is it? Right.
I think it's Steve Angeli. Like, he's been taking the a lot of the reps and played some in the bowl. I think they do like him.
Mm-hmm. Nonetheless.
They also got Kenny Minchie, who they flipped from Pitt like 2 years ago. And then they signed Lloyd Carr's grandson, CJ Carr. So that's a pretty good room. Like, I think they'll have a solution. I just, for that team to be all it can be and make the playoff, they probably need Riley Leonard and like good form Riley Leonard.
Right. Good form Riley Leonard. And of course, again, I think the wild card there that Notre Dame fans will immediately turn to is CJ Carr, right? Because he comes in with the 5-star pedigree. And as much as Angeli played well last year in the bowl game and he's the experienced guy, you know, I think you bring in Riley Leonard to be the bridge to Carr.
Yes, agreed. Or if Minchie makes a jump, but it's clearly a bridge to one of the guys that you were excited about when you signed.
All right, so we're running through some playoff teams there. You know, you're right. Texas has Quinn Ewers. You know, Washington is probably not going to be a playoff team this year. Will Rogers ended up going there. I assume he's probably the guy. That's, you know, again, I don't think Washington. I think Washington has a better chance to be more like TCU this year than a playoff team, just because they lost so much. And that's not a knock on Jed Fish. They just, you can't lose that many players. So that's an interesting one, where who might develop there, especially with Jed Fish. It was interesting that Will Rogers decided to stay there after Fish wasn't the guy who recruited him. But I think it just sort of opens up a lot of different avenues if that's not the guy who recruited you first, and but you're going there as an experienced player.
Man, the I mean, Ralph, I feel like every single guy who left that Washington offensive line is either getting like great, like rave reviews for the draft, or getting rave reviews at their new school where they portaled out to. I know they won the Joe Moore Award, so they're all good. But like, man, that's hard to quantify just how big the drop off could be there for the offensive line.
Yeah, right. And receiver, everything. Like, that's going to be, you know, again, I think I compared them to TCU, but even that is probably not a fair comparison, because I think TCU went into They went into last year with actual top 25 expectations. I wouldn't be surprised if Washington, and I'm going to have to look this up, I can't remember a team that played for a national championship and went into the next season unranked. But I believe that's what Washington's heading for.
Yeah, when I did like the initial post national title one, I had them ranked somewhere in like the teens. And after what they lost, I dropped them all the way out. If you just kind of did the blind roster test, I don't see how you can start them in the top 25.
So I don't know if this is a quarterback competition, but I think it is interesting to find out how quarterback and new coach meld. And I'm going to Alabama, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on a situation where I've seen what a Kalen DeBoer offense looks like, and I've seen Jalen Milroe play and be successful. How do those two things, how does a successful Kalen DeBoer offense and a successful Jalen Milroe, is there a world where those two things overlap?
I think there is. I actually shot a TikTok on this morning, so it might be on the CBS Sports channel sometime this month, but we're kind of banking some of these until the draft stuff's over. Do you know that Kalen DeBoer actually has had like three or four seasons where his quarterback was either his leading rusher or second leading rusher, and like to the tune of close to 1,000 yards? So he has that in him. Like, he has gone heavy QB run before, which if you're playing Jalen Milroe, unless he makes like the craziest improvement ever as a passer, his legs are still his best asset. I think Alabama can go heavy QB run. Like, the interior offensive line is really nice. You have Tyler Booker, who's one of the best guards in the country, and the kid they brought over from Washington is really nice. Brailsford,
yeah.
They get back Caden Proctor from Iowa, who certainly can run block. Well, I guess for Alabama, and then also from Iowa, you know.
Yeah.
I can see it working out there. Receiver is an area that I would anticipate Alabama attacking in the portal, given what they lost. And Milroe's going to have to be better. I mean, the guy who transferred from Georgia to Bama, the receiver.
Jermaine Burton?
So Burton had like one of the highest uncatchable rates of the draftable receivers I saw on Twitter this morning. And Texas loves Isaiah Bond, and Florida State loves Malik Benson. So those are their top three receiver targets last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did lose a lot for like Burton to be a top 100 pick. And I expect Bond to start at Texas. And I think Benson's FSU's best receiver at this point. So they did lose a lot there at receiver, and they got some super young guys. But I mean, if I'm Bama, I'm going to get an experienced receiver if I can in the spring window.
The we mentioned USC. And USC has been on a bit of a recruiting heater lately, which of course brings up opens up the door to like a really interesting conversation about Lincoln Riley and his evolution. There, we are setting up for a Lincoln Riley reset season to a certain degree. I think Lincoln Riley has the opportunity to, I'll use the term, change the narrative about him, about what he is as a coach, even though he has been a very successful coach. Last year was a speed bump that was a little more than a speed bump. It was pretty ugly at USC, and it got people thinking like all the things we worried about that were cracks in Lincoln Riley's armor kind of were exposed last year. And now part of that is going to have to be addressed in the recruiting trail. It seems like, Bud, there are some positive signs there.
Yeah, the kind of rumors around the industry are that USC's collective kind of got their money right. So that's really encouraging. If you're a Trojan fan, they have gone and done some really nice work in Georgia. Now, immediately when they got some of these kids, other recruiting industry insiders were like, yeah, let's see if these guys stick, which, hey, fair. If you're going to Georgia's backyard and taking guys that Georgia wants, that you're probably going to have a 52-week battle, right? But they go out and they get Justice Terry from Georgia, big five-star defensive lineman. They still have a commitment from Julian Lewis, who's a top five quarterback in this class. Guy reclassified, really nice prospect there. You get Isaiah Gibson, who, again, four or five-star player, big-time receiver from Warner Robins. They've gone east and gotten some big bodies and had a big-time weekend over like 2 weekends ago now. I'm curious to see how well they'll keep this up. And I'm also curious, Ralph, if you watch that bowl game, that looked more Lincoln Riley-esque offense than what some of the stuff they were running with Caleb Williams was. Mm. And I'm not saying it was wrong to do what they did with Caleb, because obviously it's Caleb. But I wonder if the drop-off will be slightly less than we think because of it being more like managed and kind of scripted up for you.
I'm interested. Yeah, there was something, my thing on USC last year, I found myself often saying this. It's not just the defense. I mean, everybody was very honed in on their defensive issues, as well they should, because the defense was at times embarrassingly bad. But I think it almost overshadowed the fact that there was something up with their offense too. And again, like, I don't know if it was a matter of you were doing things because you had Caleb, because I think now that we're going through the draft process and I hear some folks, breaking down what they saw of Caleb, there's been, listen, I'm not the X's and O's savant, so I'm going to rely on other people to say, like, they didn't like what they were doing. They didn't like what they saw was being asked of Caleb, that maybe Lincoln wasn't scheming up the best offense for Caleb. Now, they also had some offensive line issues. So, I would be interested to hear if you have an opinion, but also the opinions of people who sort of like are better at sort of dissecting the X's and O's than I am, of did Lincoln lose his way offensively too over the last year or so, maybe in relying on Caleb and his excellence to do some things that very few quarterbacks can do on a very basic level, like very, very base level. I found them over the last year or so, especially last year, just going, hey, Lincoln Riley's teams usually run better than this and are more committed to the run. So I am very interested. I want to talk with you about the defense too, but I'm also interested in what is Lincoln like sort of look when he Lincoln looks at his offense, what does he see now that needs to be emphasized or tweaked?
I assume the O-line should be better than it was last year. It's definitely a disappointment. The receivers also, they weren't amazing last year. Like Taj Washington and Brennan Rice are nice players, but they're not as good as Jordan Addison was the year before. And I think if you look at this, we'll see what they do in a spring window, but sometimes a team's action or inaction at a position is sort of a tell on what they think about their existing room.
No doubt.
Right? USC took one transfer on, like, for the offensive skill positions, Joquavius Marks. Nobody at receiver. That tells me that they think they've hit on Deuce Robinson and Zach Branch and Kyron Hudson, Jacoby Lane, Mekhi Lemon, like all these four and five star freshmen that they brought in who are really excited about playing in the Lincoln Riley offense.
Mm.
I would bet, Ralph, that they've really hit on some of these guys. Branch in particular, for those who haven't seen him play a lot because he was hurt a lot last year, that's probably the closest thing I've ever seen to Tyreek Hill as a recruit. Mm, so yeah. That's just different. And Deuce Robinson, like two sports star, really nice baseball prospect too. Good prospect pedigree. His dad was like a top 10 player in the whole country back in the 90s. Big, like jump, like kind of, jumbo receiver tight end mold. They have some unique pieces there. I think they're probably okay on offense.
Yeah. You made a good point when it comes to the idea of, you get the commits, will they hold, right? Especially when you're stretching far and wide and heading into Georgia. But so far, there have been some promising commits on the defensive side of the ball for USC. And again, it goes back to this sort of broader philosophical question of, because even at Oklahoma, this was the case where I think people looked at Oklahoma under Lincoln Riley and thought, like, they don't seem to be drawing in the bodies necessary to compete for national championships. And now we're seeing maybe a little bit of that turn. Do you think it, like, as someone who follows recruiting a little more closely than I do, is it the staff changes, like who among the staff changes, because they completely revamped the defensive staff, which of course needed to be done. Are they leading to these recruiting wins, do you think?
I think it's a combination of maybe the collective taking another step up.
I don't want to be naive. I don't want to dismiss what they've done with the collective, because I've heard the same thing, that they're getting that stuff in order.
Because they had some decent momentum last summer, and it didn't really hold. But I think the collective part, plus the newer coaches on the defensive staff, are a little bit more dynamic as recruiters. That's a nice combination to have, because it's still USC. Like, it should not be difficult to recruit to USC. And USC has certainly had good defensive players in the past. So I'm excited about what they're doing. I think if you're a fan of a Big Ten team, you're probably not very excited about what USC is doing, because – and certainly Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, Oregon are not slowing down. So if USC gets right, I mean, it's five, like, really, really good programs in that conference. And I didn't even mention the Washington team. It just played for the national title.
Yeah. And again, I think it's going to be a reset for Washington. But I will say this, and as much as I respect the hell out of Kalen DeBoer, after what I just saw Jed Fish do at Arizona, if I'm looking for a coach who can take a situation that is, you know, where the cupboard's pretty bare and get me to where I am competing at a high level in a couple of, you know, 2-3 years, like, Jed Fish has a track record of doing that at Arizona. He literally just did it at a place with that's probably not as well supported as Washington. So I'll definitely be interested to see how, you know, whether the Fish plan at Arizona can now essentially work at Washington, because as much as we don't think of it, what he took over at Arizona was just a barren wasteland, right? It's I'm certainly, in many ways, it will be better than that structurally at Washington. It will be better than that in support, general overall support of the program. And obviously you're moving into the Big Ten, where things had really gone awry at Arizona. But when it comes to just the roster build, it's pretty barren at Washington. So again, like, my sense is that Jed Fish may be the perfect person for this job.
I think so too. I mean, assuming he stays there, I'm not trying to say he won't, but like, he is certainly a guy that has had a lot of jobs in his tenure. I thought what he did with Arizona's offense was really fun. I mean, they have some studs at receiver, but Fafita's not like a special physical talent. If you've seen him in person, he's kind of tiny, and like, the arm is fine, but not special. And like, I think they scheme it up really well. Their player development, I think, has been good. I'm excited to see what he can do at Washington.
All right, let me close this up on Lincoln Riley. I strayed from him for a second, because again, I think there'll be a lot of think pieces about Lincoln Riley, I think, heading into this football season. I think there'll be a lot of, like, you know, where does USC go? Pivotal year for Lincoln Riley. Can he change his image? I remember having a long conversation with another national writer, not even after this past season, but the season before, after when they blew the Tulane game and that bowl game, and what that team looked like, how they let that potential playoff year get away. And it was this basically the theme of, like, do you think this guy can change? Like, or when you get the money, does that then make you say, well, I don't necessarily need to change? By the way, Jimbo Fisher, right? Like, Jimbo Fisher got the enormous contract, got all kinds of protection and comfort level at Texas A&M, and then dug in his heels and did not change. And my feeling was, like, Lincoln Riley is a young enough man, and I think a smart enough guy, that he can make these necessary changes. you know, the proof is in the pudding, but like, where do you stand on like the new, do you think there will be a new Lincoln Riley? Is there a second act here?
I think there probably is because of the defensive staff hires that you just made. I mean, do you go cross town to take a different DC position if you don't believe that the guy you're going to work for is going to let you run practice in the way that a defensive, defensive period should be run, right? I mean, that's sort of been one of the questions about Riley is like, can you run a practice that promotes physicality and actually like tackling and fundamental defense? I don't know that was all on the former defense coordinator. I think there probably has to be a bit of a top-down mentality, you know, to that within the program. I mean, Kirby Smart's a defensive guy, but they definitely hit. And there are offensive coaches who do let guys hit in practice.
Well, I mean, you know, Jim Harbaugh, sure, right? Jim Harbaugh was an offensive guy. Harbaugh, nobody's teams were more physical than Jim Harbaugh when they were at their best.
I mean, the guest you just had on your show, like Ohio State last year in practice, from everything we had heard, was much more physical. You know, I think, I don't know what he did at Memphis, but like Norvell, they definitely hit at FSU practice. You know, and they played good defense last year. I think Texas probably does a decent job of that now with Sarkisian. So it is possible to be an offensive guru and still allow, you know, adequate hitting and defensive development time at practice. And I think that'll be one of the big tests.
Bud Elliott from CBS Sports and 24/7. You can find him on the Cover 3 podcast. Like, you guys pump out a lot of content. You do in particular, but that your podcast is how many times a week?
So we are 3 to 4 times a week in the off season. So Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, every week, and then it's occasional bonus episodes. And then we go 6 wide during the season. So it's a lot of fun. It is a lot of content, though.
Yeah. You guys are really cranking it. I appreciate you keeping Tom Fornelli off the streets, because God knows what he'd be doing without the pod. Danny Cannell, Chip Patterson over there as well. But always appreciate your insight. You do a great job. Hopefully we get a chance to maybe bump into each other on the road somewhere.
Let's do it, Ralph. Enjoyed it, man.
And now 3 and out. First down. We're recording this the day after LSU Iowa in the Women's Elite Eight delivered a hell of a game dripping with storyline. So just excuse me a little bit here to get into some basketball and women's basketball. I promise we mostly stick to football around here, but had some thoughts on what was an amazing game. I had some lingering thoughts on what was an amazing game and spectacle and the various controversies that were attached to the run-up to LSU-Iowa. I never really thought of LSU's players being cast in the role of villains. Just Coach Kim Mulkey, who clearly embraces that role. I think it's fair to say she wants the attention and wants to be seen as someone who is fighting for, I don't know, something. She just wants to be fighting for something at all times. The Washington Post story about Mulkey received a lot of attention because she runs a common playbook used by public figures and politicians these days, you know, cast aspersions, throw out some misinformation, turn the media into the enemy and rely on your, you know, fan base in this case to follow along because how dare you question me, right? She's one of those people. Of course, the reality is the WAPO story wasn't particularly revelatory for anybody who has followed Mulkey since she was winning titles at Baylor. But it did a really good job, and as any good profile does by a really good writer, of laying out the origin story and getting at what makes her tick, what makes her, frankly, great at her job. I'll cop to being a little naive to something here when it comes to the LSU-Iowa dynamic. The fact that one team is led by a white superstar and has mostly white players, and the other is led by a black superstar with mostly black players, didn't land as significant to me. I'm not oblivious to the fact that there are lines being drawn because of the racial makeup of the two teams, but Mulkey, to me, blurs those lines because she so clearly wants to be part of the culture wars that have been so sadly used to divide our country. It dawned on me as I was listening to one of my other favorite podcasts, other than my own. You mean to tell me that Black America, progressive America, feminist America is rooting for Kim Mulkey as opposed to Caitlin Clark in Iowa? Really? That didn't jive with my way of thinking or my brain. Meanwhile, conservative white America was rooting for Caitlin Clark, the person who has become a symbol of female power and the heart of the revolution for not just women's basketball, but in some ways women's sports in general. Really? Like, none of those things, again, sort of easily fit into a well-defined box. I generally don't get too far away from sports and college football on this podcast, so I'm not going to dive any deeper into this at risk of straying from my lane. But I think what made LSU Iowa so fascinating, beyond just the great basketball, was that what each side supposedly represented and who was supposedly drawn to those sides had a lot of interesting layers to it. Second down. I guess it's not a great idea to promote other podcasts when you're doing your own, but I would recommend The Athletic Football Show's recent episode with Robert Mays, Nate Tice, and Dane Brugler breaking down the top quarterback draft prospects. Lots of good stuff, though the one thing that stuck with me was their assessment of Jaden Daniels of LSU, who I admit I never thought would become the player he turned into last year. I hadn't been able to put my finger on it, like what exactly it is about Daniels that still makes me somewhat skeptical about his pro prospects, until Nate, Robert, and Dane hit on it. As great an athlete and runner as Daniels is, he's not a creative player. He is run or pass, and he does both very well, but you don't see him make a lot of throws on the move or scramble his way into throws. There is a roboticness, if that's a word, to the way he plays that I think makes his remarkable athleticism and speed less of a weapon than it should be. I'll be interested to see if that changes in the NFL, if he can marry his two skills and become more like Lamar Jackson, a player that I think we're tempted to compare him to because of his speed and his ability to run. But if you watch them play, you don't necessarily see the same game. Third down. Taking it back to Ohio State, which is where we started this show, aside from having a team that is both crazy talented and more experienced than usual, the Buckeyes' schedule breaks great this season. I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself. I know this has come up at one point or another in the last month, few months, because it's not the first time I've noticed it, but I figured it was a good time to rehash it. The Buckeyes bailed on a home-and-home with Washington before it was determined the Huskies were joining the Big Ten, but after USC and UCLA were added, they also added some home-and-homes with Alabama and Texas coming up in the next couple of years. So there was a whole bunch of schedule machinations that led them to bail on the home-and-home with Washington that would have been this year, and it would have been Ohio State's marquee non-conference game. That's not the case anymore. Simply put, Ohio State has the Michigan schedule this year, opening with Akron, Western Michigan, and Marshall. There is no Wisconsin on Ohio State's schedule, no USC. Not that I think either of them will be top five type teams this year, but the ceilings are usually high at those programs. So it's always fair to think of them as a potential speed bump for a program like Ohio State, who wants to contend for a national championship. The Buckeyes do have a trip to Oregon in October, coming right after a visit from Iowa. They go to Happy Valley this year, but at this point, it's hard to buy into Penn State being a real threat to Ohio State, considering the results of the last few years. Though I do think Penn State will be better this season offensively than they were last year. I'm not totally willing to write off Penn State as being a team that could make some real noise in the Big Ten. The Michigan game is at home for Ohio State. In fact, the Buckeyes play 8 home games this year. To be sure, the team building at Ohio State has not been the same as it was at Michigan. Last year had all the components of a last dance type season for Michigan, from the quarterback to the head coach to a lot of the players getting ready to move on. But you can also see some parallels to the way Michigan was set up to make a big run last year and the way Ohio State is this season. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please follow so you do not miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.